Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Democrats Dan Johnson and Philip Beverly, and Republicans Chris Voronis and Bruno Barron. Program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications on State Street, that great street in Chicago where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. And again, obviously, when we were last here live a few weeks ago, I was away for the last couple of weeks. We were obviously talking about the fiscal cliff, and obviously a lot has happened in that particular area. But I don't think anyone is totally satisfied that the fiscal problems of this country are behind us. And so the new term that I introduced tonight is the fiscal showdown, because the showdown is just but a couple of months away, even in late February, early March. And that fiscal showdown is going to say that the debt ceiling will need to be raised. So we're going to go through the debt ceiling debate again. The government will run out of money. Well, we've heard that story before. And the automatic across-the-board spending cuts will kick in. They've called it sequestering. And again, if the deal is not put together or the showdown and you can't get the parties together, and there doesn't seem to be a great, at least a lot of confidence that that's going to happen. We're going to be talking about this for the next several months on this program again. Bruno Barron, I want to have you start with this. You're our one of our Republicans this evening. You're more of a libertarian, but you're a Republican.
More of a conservative, yeah.
Conservative. And my question to you is, what grade would you give the Republican leadership in the House and Senate and how they've handled the last month leading up to the fiscal cliff?
D minus. They try to comport themselves in some kind of rational way. At the end of the day, it comes down to this fact. The best deal they got was at the last debt ceiling showdown, where they had equal parts or some close to equal parts spending cuts and tax increases. Democrats want tax increases. Republicans want spending cuts. We ended up with a deal that was $44 of tax increases and $1 of spending cuts. I would call it an almost unmitigated failure. And I've always said for quite a while, especially since after Barack Obama won re-election, that we should have just gone over the cliff. It was probably, if not the best, if not politically the best idea for the Republicans, certainly the best idea policy-wise.
Chris Voronis is our other Republican this evening. Chris, what grade would you give your party leadership?
C minus, C probably, but this is not a deal. This Obama owns this deal, plain and simple. And the problem for Barack Obama is that he has this deal, because now he has to follow through on his dictum of balanced approach, which involves spending cuts. So now that he has these tax increases, I'd like to see how he defines spending cuts.
Nancy Pelosi, she said today on television that she would like to have more revenue raised. Philip Beverly, do you think it's likely that the Republicans are going to give any more on more revenue?
I don't think so. I don't think they can afford to, given the battle that they had. And, you know, the Speaker's in a really tough position. He's got a small cadre that are always going to stand in opposition because, from my perspective, they want to see government fail. I don't know what benefit there is to that, seeing government fail, but to continue to talk about government shutdowns, that was a non-starter. It was a loser in 95 when it happened. It was a loser in 2011. It's going to be a loser again if they want to keep going down that road.
As a college professor, you're used to giving grades out. So which grades would you give to the Republican leadership and to the president and those on the Democratic side?
The president probably gets a B, because I have to agree with you. He does own the deal. And I think he's going to be more willing than the minority leader, the House minority leader, to make some cuts in spending, as long as we're consistent about what those cuts are. Social Security has nothing to do with the deficit, so let's not even have that red herring thrown out there. let's talk about the stuff that needs to be cut. Why is 30% of our budget in defense and we're winding down these wars?
Dan Johnson also joins us. Dan, could the president have pushed more for more revenue?
Maybe, but I think it's a, you know, he did a good job, you know, the
deal. So you're happy with this deal?
I'm happy with it. I think the progressive base was a little upset when
65% of the Democrats are happy with the deal, 27%
that sounds about right. I think at first when the president put, you know, Social Security cuts on the table, there was some pushback from the progressive base not to talk about entitlement reform at this point and save that for a later date. And I think the fact that that wasn't part of this particular fiscal cliff arrangement, I think, was a victory from a lot of Democrats' perspective.
How far can he go in the next couple of months when we get to the fiscal showdown? And now you got to talk turkey about cuts. What can he do?
I think his appetite is to be a big problem solver. I think he'd like to do a 1986 type of tax reform. I think he'd like to help solve big problems in a big grand bargain. And I'm not sure there's nearly the same appetite for a grand bargain in either base of each party.
I'm sorry. I think you got to look at this deal for what it is. Disgusting. There's no spending cuts whatsoever with this deal. It adds $4 trillion to the deficit over 10 years.
But part of the deal is to push it back a few months before they deal with the deal. Is this a
sequester,
two-step deal?
Right, but what confidence does anyone have when this has been the policy, just to kick the can further down the road? Barack Obama has already laid down his bargaining position, which is no negotiation on the debt ceiling. He's not willing to entertain any spending cuts. So I can't understand how we're going to bring sanity back to government policy if you've got a president who's not willing to cut $1.
Bruno?
Well, and to Dan's point, I mean, are we going to have a Barack Obama who, in theory, at least in some way, shape, or form, on some press conference, says he's ready for a grand bargain, which I think should be in the offing of some sort of grand bargain? Or are we going to have the Barack Obama that John Boehner or some of the Republicans or some of the pundits say really honestly doesn't want any deal or never really did want any deal? I'd love to see the president put forth a real grand bargain. I just don't think, as Dan was saying, with a progressive base, they're going to be unwilling to see Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid on the table as they have to be on the table. Clearly, to say Social Security is not part of the deficit when, in fact, it's actually for the last 2 or 3 years been taking in less money than it needs to. So you have to be serious. And is the president going to be serious? Let's hope so.
Philip?
I'm just struck by seeing President Reagan at one of the presidential debates in 1984, speaking to the country ostensibly in that debate, but saying Social Security is not part of the deficit. And if the greatest leader of that party, even including Lincoln, says that, then when did all of that suddenly change? And to conflate these two issues, I think, is part of the problem. We need to tease out what the issues are, so the policy that addresses it is actually addressing the right problem.
When we come back, I'm going to let you respond to that. 1-800-723-8029 is the telephone number where we're listening from coast to coast and border to border. We want you to weigh in. It's been a couple of weeks since we've been live on the radio with you on Sunday night, so let's hear from you. 1-800-723-8029. If you're a Republican, how upset are you with the way in which the leadership in the House, primarily Speaker Boehner, has responded to this challenge? Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. 1-800-723-8029. We're talking about the fiscal cliff deal and also the fact that it's not a done deal yet, in that the country still faces some serious issues and they've got to be resolved in the next couple of months. And I guess the one question that I want to get from everybody is, in your view, Professor Beverly, who's got to give in the tit for tat game of politics, who has to put something on the table first at this point in time?
I think at this point the House and Senate Democrats have to really get the progressive wing on board with the idea that there needs to be some spending cuts in that might be pretty deep and might be pretty painful in the short term, but they have to
occur.
And
where are they going to be? I mean, obviously they will applaud any cut in defense, but cutting defense isn't going to be the only place where they're going to have to cut.
It's not enough. I think Department of Education is going to take some hits, and I got to say that from being a college professor. You know, areas like student financial aid, the Pell Grant program, for example, is going to take a hit.
Bruno, what would you add to that?
I'd like to see, first of all, let me be the first, maybe I'm the first conservative to say this, but when Ronald Reagan looked at the microphone and said that Social Security is not part of the deficit, he was wrong, just like every other president who said it since then or before then was wrong. The fact of the matter is you've got total yearly outflow from the government. You've got total yearly income to the government. You have various debt things that pop into the government. And what we need to do is we need to put every bit of inflow and every bit of outflow on the table. And one of the first things I'd like to see negotiated is, number one, an end to baseline budgeting, this idea that you have to have a set amount of growth in every single one of these programs. You talk about zero-based budgeting and say some programs, perhaps hundreds, just get zeroed out, shot down. And then I would like to see comprehensive, reasonable entitlement reform.
Let's just pick up on that because, again, you know, when we talk about government cuts, they are rarely, if ever, cuts. They are slow down in growth.
Right.
Well, to me, a cut is a cut means, you know what? You have it one day and you don't have it the next.
That's ending zero-based budget. Okay. I mean, that's ending baseline budgeting.
Okay. So your thought, Dan, would you as a Democrat be willing to go that far in getting serious about cutting the deficit?
Yeah, I like the idea of zero-based budgeting. I don't like the idea that you just sort of inherit the status quo from last year and then you start from there. There's no reason to think the people 20 years ago had it right. I mean, the ones that really stick in my craw, besides our trillion-dollar military, are the agribusiness corporate welfare that we all pay for. The one that I really can't stand is that we can't negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies for Medicare. That's like $160 billion that we just give to the drug companies because we don't negotiate for lower prices. So those are some of the oil subsidies. They're real. They're billions of dollars. It's ridiculous, right? And it's not. And if we had a zero-based budgeting approach to these corporate welfare tax expenditures, I think we'd do much better at reducing federal spending.
Chris?
Well, I think we should be really clear on one key point, that whatever it's going to take to get us to a balanced budget, and just to say that sounds very fanciful. But
it's not going to be in your lifetime, is it?
Probably not. But we're talking about, let's be honest, radical and painful spending cuts. The entitlement growth. I mean, just because Social Security is not on the balance sheet doesn't mean we don't have to worry about it. Chris Cox and Bill Archer did an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal a few weeks ago, and they said, if you add in the total unfunded liabilities, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and government pensions, that's $87 trillion, 550% more than our GDP. That's appalling right now. So to say that we've got a fiscal cliff deal that brings in $630 billion, you know, when in the first year, corporate subsidies, we've got corporate welfare that pay out $70 billion and we only take in $60 billion, that's obnoxious. It's ridiculous. We don't have a tax revenue problem. We have an obnoxious spending addiction.
Who do you think has to give first, Bruno? I asked the same question to Phil.
Well, first of all, I'd make the case that with a $44 of tax increases for $1, if there's even that much of spending cuts in this deal, clearly it's the Democrats' job to put something on the table. And I think entitlements have to be part of that. Just from a standpoint of, like I said, broad numbers, first thing that should be on the table is a phased-in raising of the Social Security retirement age. And to, you know, if we have to do something about means testing levels of Social Security so that the people who are already wealthy don't get as much, but the people who really need it do. You know, I have various different ideas on things that I'd like to see go, and quite frankly, corporate welfare and getting rid of the corn subsidies and all the other stupid ideas that we think is good policy here in this country. I'd say put it all on the table.
Tea Party Republicans always, you know, at least the national media, they look at the Tea Party Republicans and they say, "Boy, these are the this is the fly in the ointment. These are the people that are really, you know, they're just being so pigheaded and they're the bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
What about, and obviously Speaker Boehner has problems dealing with his maverick wing. But realistically, aren't the progressive left in the Democratic Party, aren't they equally as impossible to move?
I don't think that's fair. If you start from the premise that this is not an entitlement reform debate this year, if you start from the premise that the fiscal cliff was because the tax rates all expired, so we had to deal with that issue by the end of the year, and they created this sequester trigger, and so that was on the table. All progressives really wanted to say was, well, don't sort of get entitlement reform in the back door in the debate we're having on the rest of the budget. Let's deal with that first, keeping in mind who won the election, right? So when we talk about who ought to give, well, maybe the people that lost the election, where the people of the country rejected that premise, maybe they're the ones that ought to give a lot more.
But when you look at it as, okay, the president won the election, and he was running against the poster boy for the other side, or the perception of the other side.
Right.
But the Republicans retained control of the House.
Even
though the Democrats got more votes, I understand that. Right. But the point is, when it came, you know, the way we play this game, they still control the House. So, and again, even by the way, in the reaction to the deal, 43% of those surveyed by Gallup said they agreed with the deal, and 45% disagreed, and 15% don't know.
So, I mean, so what the heck are you talking about?
The voters want it both ways.
I'm afraid the elephant in the room here is that the president can't lead. You know, it took Joe Biden to go and make this deal, basically in 24 hours with Mitch McConnell. Barack Obama couldn't do it. He's not well-liked in Capitol Hill. He's seen as not following through on his promises. He floated some entitlement reform as part of this fiscal cliff deal, mm-hmm. Social Security. And the story in Politico goes that when Harry Reid saw it, he took the paper and threw it in his fireplace because he wanted no record that this was actually being considered. So this is the leadership that we have right now in Congress when it comes to spending and entitlement reform. And again, I say there's the problem.
Do you interpret that, by the way, we're going to take some calls in a moment. Do you interpret that based what you just said? Is that a huge step forward for Joe Biden and his presidential aspirations?
It may be, but if these next 4 years, I mean, if we go south in the next 4 years, that's hardly a legacy for him to run
on
in 2016.
Let's ask our Democrats, Dan Johnson.
I thought Joe Biden was looking great, and I think he continues to look great. I think it's premature, but always fun to talk about 2016. But I think Joe Biden right now is looking like a stronger candidate than he did 6 months ago.
Philip?
Yeah, it helps him. And I'm going to take exception to the point about him leading. It was sort of like what was happening to Sandy. The campaign sort of has to stop because he has a job to do, being the president. And maybe there's some other things going on that maybe we don't know about that he's got to attend to as well. The capital that the president has to expend as an executive can't just be thrown out there. And part of that capital is his time. That he's even involved in these negotiations seems to be a little troubling to me. This is like, Dad, come on, suck it up and do your job as House and Senate Republicans. Your job and stop expecting the president to bail you out.
Last time I checked, the president was the chief executive of the United States.
He spends the money that the Congress appropriates.
I think it's an interesting point, but I would have to say I disagree. I think going back to the point that you made a few minutes ago, Bruce, is very important. The theory is out there that these crazy Tea Party people are refusing to let the Republicans do what they should do, which is raise taxes. If there is any truth to that, and quite frankly, I think that taxes in anything that we have to do, you were saying $87 trillion. If it's $87 trillion, we need to put everything on the table. We need to put our big boy pants on, and the Tea Party needs to swallow tax increases, and the progressive wing has to swallow entitlement reform, and they have to swallow it hard, and there's no way around it. And anyone who says different is literally, honestly, either lying to themselves or lying to the people.
Or on drugs.
Or on drugs.
If only we could negotiate for those drugs. Medicare, right?
Well, of the 234 House Republicans elected November 6th, only 39%, or 16.6%, were reelected with 55% of the vote or less. That's the traditional benchmark that determines vulnerability in the future. Of that same group, only 15 of the 234, that's 6%, represent districts that Obama won in 2012. And so the great fear that every Republican has is they are far more susceptible to a primary challenge, i.e. losing their jobs,
yep,
than virtually any Democratic member of Congress. So they're a little bit more skittish than the Democrats. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. You're listening to Beyond the Beltway. When we come back, we got a full board of lights, and we'll bring the folks in, and we'll share their thoughts. Don't go away. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us from coast to coast and border to border. Before I go too much further, I want to thank Dan Proft for sitting in last week and hosting our program. It was nice to listen to the program out there in Radio Land as opposed to sitting around the table, but I enjoyed it. In fact, we've been doing this show for a long time, and I hope that you enjoy listening and watching this show. We're a television show in Chicago. I hope you enjoy listening and watching it as much as I enjoy doing it. Dan Johnson also joins us. Dan Johnson is the head of Progressive Public Affairs. He is a graduate of the University of Chicago Law School. Barack Obama was his law professor and gave him a good job. Yeah. And things are going well with the Progressive Public Affairs.
They're good. You know,
representing. Do you ever represent anything right of center or moderate?
Yeah, one of my clients is the Small Business Advocacy Council, so we're a small business group, and we're tackling unemployment insurance and trying to change some of the corporate welfare we have in Illinois this session.
Very good. Bruno Barrett also joins us. He is executive director of For the Good of Illinois and hails from Lake Forest, Illinois. And tell us a little bit. You're also a lawyer by training, but you don't practice a lot. Is that correct?
I'm a lawyer by training, but I don't practice a lot. The only two lawsuits I've ever filed were against the state of Illinois for unconstitutional ballot language on the ConCon question. And then we also sued the state of Illinois, a client down in Champaign, who I actually co-authored a book on the Constitution with. We sued Illinois because there's a balanced budget clause in the Constitution, and we haven't had a balanced budget in 30 years. And then actually tomorrow we are announcing a lawsuit against the Republican comptroller for failing to disclose public information through the Freedom of Information Act. And we're getting very active on the legal front, so I actually may have to dust off my law degree.
So you file suit against anybody?
No, usually I'll file a suit against a recalcitrant government when it's doing things that it shouldn't be doing or not doing things that it should be doing.
Philip Everly also joins us. He's an associate professor of political science at Chicago State. He's been there for 21 years. It's hard to believe you're a very young-looking man, so you must have, right out of high school.
It feels like.
Directly to teaching college. Also with us this evening is Chris Veronis. He is the president of ASOP Communications, and ASOP Communications in 50 words or less. What sort of clients do you look for other than those that pay?
Well, first and foremost, those are the clients ASOP
so no
most
politicians.
Likes. We are a firm that helps clients find and tell their stories. And clients who are looking for their PR programs to be run by campaigns, they come to us.
Very good. Well, that's our group around the table. Let's head to the phones right now. Let's head to Crisp in Palatine, Illinois, listening to us on our flagship station. Go ahead. You're on WLS, and you're on Coast to Coast.
Yes, gentlemen. First of all, Happy New Year to everyone.
Happy New Year to you.
And my initial comment was about negotiating drug prices for Medicare, which, of course, one of your guests already mentioned. I mean, if we did just what the VA does, we could save, about $160 billion easily there. And what I would do actually is take it one step further, and I would look at what the drug companies are charging at the lowest price anywhere in the world. That would be the ceiling. There would be no price above that, and I would negotiate down from those levels. But if we look at all the other things, let's look at how much money is being spent and wasted in the Defense Department. You cannot even audit the Defense Department. They don't know where they're spending their money. Let's eliminate some of their useless weapon platforms that they're talking about. Let's look at the military bases, not only overseas, but let's look at why do we have a SAC base in the middle of Nebraska, for crying out loud. You know, it made sense in 1950, doesn't make sense in the year 2013. You know, let's look at all these other things. Let's start closing these military bases that are, you know, right now, you know, just a waste of money.
Well, just to pick up on that particular point, I mean, years ago, because Republicans and Democrats really could not agree, they created this base closing commission, and there was bipartisan investigation and sort of independent, you know, really smart decisions were made about what was useful and what was useless, and they presented a huge list. And Congress either had to take everything on the list or nothing on the list. Everything was up or down. And it was sort of a way that gave everyone, all 435 members of Congress, it gave them sort of, you know, political cover. And I'm just wondering, Philip, if that concept, just to follow up on what Chris has to say, would that concept work in other budget-cutting items or areas that need to be cut, that literally you'd get some real smart people who had no political axe to grind, and they would force the politicians to do something courageous.
I thought we just did that, and it was rejected.
Supercommittee.
The supercommittee. And
Maybe we need another supercommittee or different people on the supercommittee.
I think we have to get, unfortunately, pushed to the point of taking some drastic action. Right now, I don't think we're there yet, if that makes sense.
Well,
yeah, logically we might be there, but the story that people have, people are living their lives day to day and don't see how really critical fixing some of these problems are.
Bruno?
This is an example of the utter and complete cowardice of the people who are elected to office in Congress in both parties. Fact of the matter is, the base closing commission was something that might work because everybody knew somebody's ox was getting gored, and it was a small enough issue, even though it seemed big at the time, it was a small enough issue that you could isolate bases and then have some kind of non-political committee and say, oh, we don't have to worry about it anymore. This is the real deal. This is the fiscal future of the United States of America, and whether we go the absolute wrong direction, pretending that there's not a problem, or whether we go in the right direction. And both parties have to man up, to speak.
Well, you know, I thought Chris's, the caller's point was interesting. And I think there's sort of a debate in the progressive cause where I think cutting spending is a real opportunity for progressives to say, absolutely, the $1 trillion military, let's cut it. $160 billion of spending that we essentially do to the drug companies because we don't negotiate it, let's cut it. And I think we have a real opportunity to own cutting government spending, so we have a 21st century government for a 21st century economy. Instead of getting locked into the false narrative that we're just against any spending cuts.
It's absurd, honestly. And I'll be really honest. I mean, Republicans have dirty hands.
There is waste in the defense.
And that's part of the sequester. And if nothing is done, those cuts are automatic. I don't see the same kind of sequester happening with Social Security or Medicare. But, you know, frankly, Republicans do have dirty hands on this issue. Unfortunately, we've created these huge sprawling entitlement programs with these constituencies, these vast constituencies. And anyone who thinks about tampering with them gets a primary, is kind of run out of office. The real issue here is the Democratic ignorance of these issues, which is criminal and cowardly. That this kind of negligence has been happening for so long.
You know,
we've gotten to the point where you've got a president who can't lead his own party, where you've had past presidents like Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill who have come together on tax reform.
Is this the same party that fought two wars with tax cuts?
One at a time.
The same party that fought two wars with tax cuts that had never been done in our history? Is this the same party that had the House, the Senate, and the White House with the Supreme Court from 2001 until 2007 that drove the national debt up $7 trillion? Is that the same party
is
now the one that's going to fix this problem?
Yes. First of all, it's exactly the same party. And as Chris said accurately, the Republican Party has dirty hands on this as well. The idea that one party is worse than the other one on spending, I think that ideologically, the Democrats are worse on spending, and that's not necessarily meaning a pejorative. But the Republicans, if nothing else, they cut this deal in the last debt ceiling vote, and then they went back on their own deal because they were too chicken to allow cuts to their constituency.
And, Democrats generally, they take care of their constituencies better than the Republicans. Would you agree with that?
No, not the 1%.
I disagree.
It depends
the 1%ers are getting over.
It depends on who those constituencies are. If you're saying they take care of their
if you're part of Romney's 47%,
there's a big split in who really honestly makes up the entire breadth of the Republican Party or who thinks about voting Republican from election to election. The fact of the matter is the corporate guys probably do get better taken care of than they should be, and the Tea Party probably doesn't get taken care of as well
and
as
the
it should be.
And the military always gets taken care of.
Unfortunately, yes.
Let me ask one question.
Not the military. Yeah.
What about the Social Security constituency? And by the way, I'm Social Security, I'm Medicare, okay?
Congratulations.
I want my check.
Why not?
I've got to ask you this question.
I can't wait for the middle of the month. It's really exciting. But again,
but you paid into that, right?
I did, yeah.
So you made contributions to it. So it really isn't an entitlement, something you paid into.
I view it as an entitlement.
The Supreme Court of the United States said it's an entitlement. The Supreme Court of the United States said that any Congress and president signing a bill at any time could cut any benefit. They could cut it to zero. They could raise it. They could lower it. It's an entitlement. All we're asking is let the retirement age go to 72 in a phased-in period of time, have nobody who's people who are earning
current. For you. You're fine, right? Right.
Well, as long as they don't grandfather it in, no pun intended.
fair enough. And the thing is that you don't have to cut anybody's current benefits to Social Security to fix most of this problem. You just have to start fixing it for the long term. And I would say that any Democrat or progressive or liberal who says you can't touch entitlements is as intransigent, as insane as any Tea Party guy who says you can't raise taxes.
Do you agree with that?
I absolutely agree that there's nothing wrong with remaking entitlements. I think it's absolutely something that's always got to be talked about. I think it was the wrong time to do it during the fiscal cliff debate because that wasn't driving the fiscal cliff. And I think the progressives were right not to put that in the debate. But I would say on Social Security in particular, this is what most people depend on for their pension. The idea that you're getting a company-sponsored pension, that's going away. We ought to be increasing Social Security, not cutting.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8029. Lots of callers on the line. Wall-to-wall calls when we come back. I'm Bruce Dumont, wherever you're listening. Coast to coast and border to border tonight. Nice to have you with us. From Redding, Pennsylvania to Redding, California, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Let's head west to Redding, California, where Bryant is listening to us on KQMS. Nice to hear from the Golden State, where I spent all of the last 2 weeks. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the wet weather at that time.
Yeah, it was cold. I mean, it was a lot warmer than Chicago, but it was, 40 degrees at night, California, so good thing I brought my sweaters along.
Not too bad. Welcome, gentlemen. The question I have, and it's something that upsets me, we always jump on the Republicans for not trying to, be bipartisan or to compromise, yet the Senate has not passed a budget that's been approved by the House, hadn't even brought it up to a vote in the last 3.5 years.
Well, again, we occasionally discuss this on this program, but I think you were correct that when the national media is sort of analyzing who's got to give more, I mean, there's always, in my view, there's much more focus that the Republicans seem to be out of step or not willing to compromise, and you're right. I mean, every Democratic member of the Senate should be grilled regularly when they appear on these programs as to why, where is their leadership?
Which, by the way, President Clinton said that was indefensible when the Congress was running on continuing resolutions, exactly what we're doing right now.
Right.
Well, just really quickly jumping in here, I mean, this is not something you blame on the Democrats or the Republicans or the left or the right. The fact of the matter is, for whatever reason, whether it's a combination of the extreme left and extreme right, along with the combination of the very powerful corporate interests that own sections of both parties, the fact of the matter is our government has stopped working. And I think the gentleman is correct that there should be a rule that the Senate has to pass a balanced budget. Maybe it's in the Constitution, maybe it's not in the Constitution, or pass a budget regardless, and at least take the hit that you have to take for passing a budget and voting a budget out and saying this is what we put in our budget.
And maybe pass that budget with just a majority.
Right.
How's that? Instead of having everything that the Democrats seem to want to bring up in the Senate have to become a supermajority vote. How about just pass it on a majority?
Brian, last word to you, then we're going to move on.
I think it would be better that any measure that is voted on by the House and passed by the House has to be brought to the floor and voted on. If they disagree with it, they go to committee or whatever. But there has to be a vote taken. In fact, I think the articles indicate that that has to be done.
The articles? What do you mean?
Yeah, the articles of the Constitution.
No, there's nothing in there about that.
I do not believe there is, but it's a good rule. I'd be for it. I'm with you on that.
As long as it goes both ways. Whatever gets voted out of the Senate, the House has to vote on.
Do you agree with that, Brian? It's got to work both ways?
Yes, I do.
Okay. I think we have a national movement growing here.
We have all the
three people. We have three people that are already on the bandwagon. Brian, thanks very much. Again, thanks for your call from Redding, California. Let's head to the panhandle of Florida, where Lisa is listening to us in Pensacola, Florida, listening to us on Sirius Satellite Radio tonight. Nice to hear from Sirius Radio. Go ahead.
Hi, Bruce.
Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to say something about entitlement reform, about the other side of Social Security that I never hear anyone discuss, but as a neonatal intensive care nurse, I see a lot of it. It's the disability side of it.
Uh-huh.
I hear about raising the retirement age, but then what I see from my perspective every day is just people getting checks because their babies are born premature or that they have a child. And I'm a Democrat. I don't want to sound like I'm a cut-everything Republican. But I just see this abuse, and I wonder, is that just such a small percentage? Is that why it's not discussed, or can I get some of your viewpoints on that?
When you, in other words, in your view, your anecdotal testimony tonight is that that's fairly widespread?
Well, yes, from what I see, yes. The people who have children that are disabled just automatically get, medical care, daycare, their food stamps, all that they need. Plus a giant check to live on. Well, not giant. I'm not going to say giant. But a check to live on also. So, and just even adults that are disabled that get. And does no one want to be the person that says, hey, let's take the money from the sick people?
Well, all right, let's talk about a political reality. You've brought up an issue, and you've brought up a protected class of citizens in this country, which are people who are disabled. I can't think of too many Republicans or Democrats that necessarily want to start the discussion there, even though
right.
You may say it's like nobody wants to take veterans benefits away. That's to me that's sort of like a third rail of politics as well. But what about it?
Well, first of all, she's raising a very important point, and Lisa, don't apologize if you're a Democrat and saying, I don't want to sound like a Republican. I think Democrats and Republicans across the country should stop identifying with this wing or that wing or the progressive or the Tea Party or whatever and start talking like common sense citizens as you are, bringing up a really important issue. I don't know the exact facts, and I remember right before the election reading something about the aggressive expansion of the number and the size in spending of people on old age, and Social Security is called old age and survivor's disability insurance. So it's the disability insurance. It is a very large part. It's not as large as retirement, but it is a large part of Social Security spending. And this was one of the deals that goes back to Reagan, where he supposedly fixed Social Security when they tightened up some of the rules on disability, and that was controversial at that time. Again,
yeah.
It all comes back to putting everything on the table.
No, Lisa, thanks for right. your call. Go ahead, Chris.
And in fact, you've got gratuitous ways with Medicare, which is at least $60 billion a year. But these problems are endemic in the programs themselves. So you've got fraud, you've got rules from the feds, you've got rules from the state, you've got declining reimbursement, and of course that hurts doctors. And of course that could lead to reduced access to care. And so here you have these expensive, untenable programs. And guys, we're seeing it happen at this table right here. This aversion to at least talking about entitlement reform. Because it's all tax increases and defense. That's your answer.
We are going to talk about it for another whole hour. Yes. And if you're listening to us on radio, you're going to hear that discussion. If you're watching us on television in Chicago, you can just think about what we're going to talk about when you leave us. But our thanks to Dan Johnson and Philip Beverly and Bruno Behrend and Chris Veronis for being with us in hour number one. And again, for those on radio, there's going to be an hour number two. Don't go away. I'm Bruce Dumont, live from Chicago. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway, tonight featuring commentary by Dan Johnson, who's a Democrat with Progressive Public Affairs. Fellow Democrat this evening is Philip Beverly, Associate Professor of Political Science at Chicago State University. And our Republicans tonight, Chris Veronis, he is the president of ASOP Communications. And Bruno Behrend joins us. He is the executive director of For the Good of Illinois. He, too, is a Republican. So a couple of Republicans, a couple of Democrats trying to solve the issues of war and peace here this evening as it relates to the budget. And I've come up with some interesting ideas from those listening from coast to coast and border to border. We have people standing on the line, continuing our discussion from the last hour in which we talked about the financial showdown that is before us and all the things that need to be done in the wake of the fiscal cliff deal, which obviously didn't resolve everything, and the fact that by late February and early March, the debt ceiling debate is once again going to be with us because it's going to have to be raised again, or maybe not, but everyone thinks that that's likely to happen again. The government's going to run out of money. We've heard that story before, and that needs to be refunded. And then the package of automatic across-the-board cuts in military and domestic spending, that's likely to kick in as well, unless both sides get together and find a way to avoid that. And we've been talking about ways in which government can cut spending, and the Democrats are still talking around the table this evening about maybe raising additional revenues, and that's certainly something that Nancy Pelosi has spoken about, but we'll find out how you feel as well. Let's head to Hubbard, Ohio, where Jack is listening to us on WKBN. Nice to hear from Ohio tonight. Go ahead, Jack.
Bruce, I just want you to know I'm in the hot tub again.
Very good. Oh, you're the man that listens in the hot tub in Hubbard,
yes,
Ohio.
Yes, sir, and I'm listening to you since 7 o'clock.
Very good. Well, you're probably all shriveled up by now.
Oh, no, I'm in good shape. I just want to tell you this, good. Bruce.
Yeah.
That for the last week, I bet you I must have heard it a dozen times, that everything you want to take away is a drop in a bucket. The other night,
yep,
I put a bucket in the sink, and I let it drop one drop for every hour, and the next morning I had a couple inches of water in there. We have to start somewhere, Bruce.
I agree.
Then listen here. One gentleman talked about closing bases in overseas.
Right.
Pittsburgh shut down a C-130 base there quite a few years ago. Youngstown shut part of theirs down. Dayton's talking about shutting some of theirs down. Why couldn't these soldiers be brought back to the States and put them on those jobs? I thank you very much, Bruce. And, Bruce, you got an open invitation. You ever come through Hubbard again, my wife will cook you the best spaghetti dinner you ever had.
Whoa, wait a
then
minute.
I get a spaghetti dinner, and then I jump in the hot tub?
Yeah, you can jump in the hot tub.
Okay. Well, you got to wait a little while. All right, listen. Thanks very much, Jack. Open invitation, the hot tub in Hubbard, Ohio.
So I didn't get exactly what Joe was saying, and I'm hoping to give a good enough answer that I, too, get
invited. Close the bases overseas.
For sure.
And maybe bring some of those troops home, although I guess the question is, if you close the bases overseas, maybe you don't need the personnel.
Look, well, they're already in the process of shutting down a lot of the stuff going on in the military. I think it was number one. They talked about the 800,000 people who are not civilians who are employed by the Pentagon. My son's a Marine. They're already downsizing the Marines, or the plans are already there to downsize the Marines. So you're going to see a lot of downsizing of the military automatically anyway, which, again, assuming that we're not cutting into muscle and we're only cutting into fat, doesn't really bother me as much.
Wait a minute.
There
is no automatic downsizing of the military. We've almost doubled since 9/11 occurred. The idea that the military is some small and nimble entity.
It's not a small and nimble entity, but it's not a trillion-dollar military either. It's a $711 billion entity.
But the biggest percentage is personnel, though.
It's not the biggest percentage of the defense budget are not new weapons.
It's
They're
personnel.
People.
Yeah.
People.
Yeah. There's way too many military
Philip.
People.
And I think we have to take a look at some of the weapon system stuff. The F-35, for example. I'm an Air Force guy, so we don't need an F-35. We probably didn't need the F-22. These are multi-billion-dollar weapon systems that we probably don't need, and yet we got them.
Okay, so in the spirit of getting somewhere, I'd be open to talking about the Joint Strike Fighter. Do we need it? You know, do other countries have superior technologies? That's fine. But I want to hear from you guys. You know, where's Medicare?
Exactly. Yeah.
Where's Medicare from you guys? Which dwarfs the Pentagon budget by comparison? And let me just
How would you cut it? Give us how would you like Medicare?
Medicare?
Yeah.
You know, some of the ideas in the Simpson-Bowles Commission are good ones. The means testing, okay. Phasing in an age. You know, and honestly, frankly, if you're talking to me, I'd be open to vouchers.
$60 billion of fraud.
I'd be open to privatizing. I'd be open to privatizing healthcare and giving it back to individuals to create some price competition.
And at what age? At what age? Because, again,
everyone is 72, 73.
In any campaign, the Democrats go out of their way trying to say, okay, we're not going to – if you're over 65 or you're over 55, you're not going to be cut. Even Mitt Romney was talking about.
Yeah.
You know, so at what age? I mean, is it – at what point should an American have the option to choose either Social Security and a Medicare system or some option that they will determine? Is it 35? Is it 40? Is it 45? Because then it seems to me that you'd be able to at least project the economic impact on it.
What's
a good age?
Well, I think that all of this stuff can be studied and done on a sliding scale. I mean, there's entire think tanks on the left and the right that do this kind of stuff. But you basically say if you're 55 and older or 50 and older, you're going to have your choices, but we're not going to leave you high and dry. And if you're under 50, you should start planning for different things, and here's the various different ways you can do it. This is the thing that bothers me, again, about the left. And it's not that we can't come together or come to some kind of agreement, but demonizing someone for coming up with a voucher idea when it's actually a pretty good idea that can literally work for everybody.
Wait a minute.
Doesn't make sense.
So this is after the Affordable Care Act extended the life of Medicare and cut $750 billion in dumb spending that Medicare has been doing. What did the Republicans say? This fiction that you're taking money from Medicare and putting it into Obamacare as if it's an entity that exists. The idea that Republicans don't run campaigns saying that Democrats are trying to cut your Medicare is false. Those are all the commercials I saw on Chicago television, Republicans attacking Democrats. So just be honest that Democrats are not the only ones here trying to demonize the other side that you're cutting Medicare spending.
I would be more concerned, less concerned about the actual nuts and bolts of it. I'm actually more concerned about the process that we get to it, because here's the reality. You may have good policy. The reality is it's bad politics, and politicians are going to do the political thing. So until you create a process that gets you to that outcome.
Who creates that, Phil?
So I look at Simpson-Bowles, for example.
You can't see Boehner or Reid taking the lead on this.
No, I don't.
It's got to be the president.
He's got
to step forward. He's got to outline his vision for what a grand bargain is.
Okay.
And it cannot be tax increases.
He outlines his vision for it, and you're going to tell me that this Republican House and Republican Senate is going to give that vision a fair hearing. Is that what you're going to tell me? Because that would be fiction.
That's not going to happen because he's still dealing
with Mitch McConnell, who failed in his job to keep him from getting reelected, by the way. He still has to deal with that guy.
The same guy who got the fiscal cliff deal going. The same guy who started with $630 billion tax increase plan.
When we come back, we're going to find out if there's any issue that our guests all agree on as to where to cut. Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, and during the break, we took a little respite from our discussion of fiscal-related stuff, and we got into an interesting discussion. We're talking about, I certainly wouldn't put this on the list of things that people could instantly agree on, but in the wake of the Sandy Hook, Connecticut tragedy, there has been discussion. We've had it here for the last several weeks on the program as to whether there needs to be tighter gun control, and also whether or not there has to be expanded more responsibility on the part of our popular culture media companies, and also greater widespread access to mental health intervention. And I think it's a combination of all those three things that I think we need. But one of the ideas that came out was a suggestion by the head of the NRA that perhaps there should be an armed guard in every school. Of course, some people have suggested that maybe teachers need to be armed. I don't think arming teachers is a good idea at all. But I think the idea of having an armed guard in every school is not a bad idea. Now, who would like to agree or disagree with me?
I think it's missing the point. I mean, there was an armed guard at Columbine, you know, Fort Hood is a military base. I think the idea that we're going to, like, shoot the mentally deranged mass murderer by having people around, it reminds me of, like, Reagan's missile defense. You know, it's the root cause is not that we don't have enough armed guards protecting people, because, you know, you can have an armed guard in every movie theater, right? I mean, you can have armed guards patrolling the streets of Chicago. I don't think the solution, I don't think that's the root cause. We've got a culture of violence, and the truth is we have far too many guns that are far too widely available. We don't
even have I would say that it is not specifically or uniquely the gun. We have too many people who are mentally ill.
We do.
Who are inspired by a popular culture that has given very little credence to the value of life. And it's a combination of that. You have young people growing up. Drugs might be part of it, but primarily the common denominator in these horrendous crimes is there's a mental health issue.
And to take it a step further, a broken family, too. The right. Absence of strong parents. No. And you know, nature abhors a vacuum, and you know, deranged people, monsters are you thrive in a vacuum without.
But pop culture plays
to
those that are on the borderline, especially the gaming industry as well as the motion picture industry, more so than television. Certainly, the music industry I think contributes to that as well. As far as it's a disrespect for women, a disrespect for life. Disrespect and a glorification of violence.
Well, and a couple of points. Number one, and I disagree with Dan that it's all about the number of guns.
That's not what I said.
Well, what you said is we have too many guns and we have too violent of a society and that you can't have shootouts. The fact of the matter is that there ought to be a way, whether it's armed guards, which I'm a little bit more skeptical about, or whether you give some teachers who want to, through a legal process proper training and proper licensing. The fact is that if people start understanding that there are people around universities or movie theaters or places where they can defend themselves, I was asked once after one of these train shootings in New York, it's like, well, you don't want to have a shootout in a train car. It's like, well, I'd rather have a shootout in a train car than have only one person shooting and killing everybody. But the other point, and this I haven't verified this, so I'm not 100% sure. Don't take it verbatim, but I saw one of those emails going around that listed all of these shootings in America and a couple other countries, Canada, and going to the mental health issue, but also going to the fact that one thing in common, even more in common than guns, because one of these things was a mass murder, or at least five or six people with a knife, mm-hmm. was psychotropic pharmaceuticals, antidepressants. Mm-hmm. Now, if we're going to ban guns, let's ban antidepressants, or at least if we're going to strictly control guns, let's strictly control antidepressants. And to sit there and say, oh, that doesn't have anything to do with it, I think is absurd. The fact is we have millions and millions of law-abiding Americans with guns. They don't go into schools. They don't shoot anybody up. But the fact is that the mentally ill and a lot of these people very often are on very, very strong psychotropic drugs.
And some of the states in the country, they don't share information about you know, one's medical background that they shouldn't have guns. I mean, to me, that would be a no-brainer to start, you know, sharing that information.
Well, and, you know, Bruce, this is as good a time as any to bring this point up, because we have, you know, a bunch of really smart people around this table. We reflect the smart ideas of a lot of other policy people, and a lot of this has to do with trust. The fact of the matter is, a lot of rational conservatives would sit there and say, yes, there should be sharing of information, and yes, maybe there should be much more strict access. Maybe if you're on an antidepressant, you have to be off an antidepressant for a year before they even allow you to buy a gun. And the fact is that there's a lot of reasonable regulation and policies across the spectrum that we simply wouldn't allow to happen on the extremes of the progressive or the Tea Party or something, because we don't trust the other side. They think we're going to try and undermine and destroy Medicare and Medicaid and throw grandma off the cliff, which is, of course, nonsense. And then we think that, you know, the minute you regulate one thing about guns, then they're going to be knocking at your door to take the guns away. Where's the trust?
Well, but also, when you're talking about, you know, taking a problem and going back to its root and how you solve it, you know, and we've been talking about health care costs and health care. I mean, for mental illness not to be included in health insurance programs is absurd. Now, it's going to be expensive. There's no question about it. But, you know, a nation that is concerned exclusively with the physical maladies of its citizens. I mean, someone who has cancer will ultimately die. They're not going to take 15 people with them. People who are mentally ill and not and have it undealt with in some way. Those are people they're going to the circle of people, the ring of people that they will affect is far more than a cancer patient. And you don't think twice about treating cancer or heart disease or obesity or whatever the physical problem is. But we live in a country where no one, no Republican, Democrat, nobody talks seriously about including mental illness. As a disease that has got to be treated and seriously. Insurance companies have got to be talking about these issues because it is the common denominator. Maybe it's a common denominator. I was very pleased that, you know, although the president tends to, you know, speak more about, a greater cut down or greater crackdown on guns because he is Democrat, he is liberal. That's the first issue that they always bring up in the wake of this. But I was pleased with a couple of comments looking at, you know, the totality of Sandy Hook, that it wasn't just guns. I mean, in this particular case, the mother was a collector of guns. I mean, you know,
lawfully. Video games.
So the question is, it's what's the culture? You know, it was a broken home as well. But again, the parents that are out there that are listening to this program tonight, and we say this after every one of these tragedies, there are parents out there this evening who are crying for help to try to solve the problems that they're having with their children, and they got no place to go. They have no place to go because their insurance doesn't cover it. If they're real, real poor, they may be able to go and get some help. If they're real, real rich, they can spend $200 for a psychiatrist. Well, but if you're in the middle, you got no place to go. You're hoping and you're praying that your son or daughter, usually it's a son, isn't going to go crazy someday and kill a lot of people.
And it's easier for politicians on both sides to politicize the gun angle of it because it's much more tangible. And it's the easy thing to say, oh, no, we have to reduce the numbers or the
but then everybody goes to their respective sides, and we have it three or four times a year, and no one says, because the only person, and again, he's long gone from the Senate, but Pete Domenici, the senior senator for many years from New Mexico, was one of the few members at the national level who ever had serious discussions about mental health because it had affected his family, and so he had a personal interest.
So did Paul Wellstone, right? And one of the mental health parity acts was named after Paul Wellstone.
Gordon Smith of Oregon, too.
Yeah, right. His son committed suicide. Yeah. Right. Well, there's got to be more of those kind of discussions. And the other issue, when, you know, getting back to what society might agree on, I'm wondering if we look at the costs. The fiscal costs and the mental anguish as well for our propensity to to lock people up and throw away the key. I mean, just this massive incarceration of people in this country. I mean, that's a government, you know, the prison system is a government program
complex.
That doesn't work.
That's right. Yes.
It doesn't work.
And that's some government spending that we can get behind, cutting that.
Right.
And by the way, that's something that conservatives and liberals can agree on.
They should. Let them all out on the street.
Good luck owning the crime issue then.
Because look at what just happened just in Illinois. We finally, thanks to Governor Quinn, pushed very hard over opposition in his own party, shut down the worst prison in the state, TAMS, which has well outlived its useful life. And that thing is shut down as of last week. That's a success. There was another
And a couple of weeks ago on this program, and again, we have a lot of listeners on KLBJ in Austin, Texas. I mean, this group called Right on Crime. If you've not looked them up, Right on Crime. It is a consortium of conservative folks who believe the criminal justice system needs dramatic reform.
Yeah,
and it's
absolutely
about a fiscal issue, and it's about common sense, and it's, you know, the same issues that drove politicians of all sides to say, we've got to change the welfare system because it doesn't work. You could say the exact same thing and make the exact same case for the prison industrial complex. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
It's a waste of money. It gets into broader issues of, you know, the mental health issues that I'm talking about, because a large percentage of those in prison do have mental problems and they're not being treated in prison. It gets into the legal, you know, the drug issue as to whether or not we're. It just opens all kinds of further discussions.
Oh, and maybe if we could.
This is part of the things we should discuss.
I think you would have.
And by the way, I want to come back now. Let me get off my soapbox. I'll let you all jump on yours when we come back. 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. He said a second to third time. We are going to go to calls in just a moment after I mention that everyone around the table this evening is here, and they're very articulate. Dan Johnson is here. He is with Progressive Public Affairs. He is a Democrat. His fellow Democrat, his tag team Democrat tonight, is they all have their shorts on and their tank tops. Philip Beverly, he is an associate professor of political science at Chicago State University. The Republican team tonight wearing their red, white, and blue outfits. Chris Voronis from ASOP Communication and Bruno Barron. He is the executive director for the good of Illinois. We'll go to calls in just a moment. Somebody wanted to jump on what I said before the break?
Well, I think you could have a thoughtful conversation about prison reform. I think it could be bipartisan.
Yes.
One thing you can't overlook, though, is that we're enjoying historically low crime rates.
Yes.
Largely responsible to truth in sentencing laws that kept violent criminals off the streets. The public wants this. That's not to say that we can't have an intelligent, thoughtful discussion about prison reform. I think you were saying earlier, Bruno, some people should be exiting prison, and some criminals should be entering it.
But again, if you send people away, and when they're away, there is no remedial program.
Yes.
There's nothing going
True.
On. How does anyone with any brain think that that person is going to be better when they're through with their 3, 6, 9, or 12 years?
Because returning, they tend to have to return, in California at least, I'm a little bit familiar with that, they have to return on parole to the environment where they committed their crime.
Right.
So they're going back into the same environment that got them incarcerated in the first place. And the pull of the life is hard. If you've got nothing in terms of reentry for them, you're guaranteed.
And part of that prison, by the way, just the politics of it, because not only in Illinois, but virtually in every state. State legislatures we're decades now. The Republican members of the legislatures, their trade-off in supporting things for big cities, they got a prison in their district. So the road to Springfield, Illinois, is paved with prisons. That's the same case in every state capital, maybe not every state capital.
And it's paved with pavers, and it's paved with asphalt on every interstate every 2 years.
So all that's done, but the other side of that coin, which is politically, is the unions, the AFSCME union, who represent the prison guards. They are in many cases are the major funders of some of these. Let's get tough on crime. You know, the three strikes and you're out. What happened in Arizona? They like the idea of the prison industrial complex because they get jobs out of it. So it's a jobs program for Republican lawmakers. It's a jobs program for the Democratic-controlled AFSCME union, and the prisons get. And again, it's an easy thing. Let's lock them up and throw away the key. Again, fiscally, it makes no sense.
And social cost is also too great for us to bear, especially in communities of color that are disproportionately incarcerated. And all you have to do is look at Mark Maurer's sentencing project data on the disparity in sentencing between African-American defendants and white defendants on the same
crime.
Yeah.
Which incidentally makes a lot of sense. And yes, those are all things you have to look into. The thing that gets me, and this again, Bruce, you know this is my favorite topic. A lot of that problem could be solved if we started educating our children better.
I agree, totally.
And the easiest way to educate children better is to have a vast new array of education resources and kinds of schools, which comes right back to a lot of this sits on this idea that we have these public employees over on this side, we have public employees over on that side. It's time to stop thinking about public employees, and it's time to start thinking about what is the best way to allocate resources so that kids get better educated in the city, around the country, and stop thinking about these massive bureaucracies and start cutting them.
I agree. Let's go to calls. John in Crete, Illinois, listening to us on WLS. You've been waiting a long time. You're on the air. Go ahead, John.
Okay, thanks, Bruce, for taking the call. I want to get back to this word entitlement. I don't like it. And first of all, Franklin Roosevelt started that in the 40s. If you talk just wanting Social Security, which people get, that you pay into. You gloss over and blur and say, those who get food stamps. If someone needs food stamps and public aid, that's something else. But to say they do not give money for food stamps, they don't put money into public aid. So I think it's a false dichotomy to say that's now, if you get into Medicare, that's something else. And now I want to make one comment about guns. You failed to mention about, I think the Supreme Court said about 2 years ago or so that watching violent video games with guns is good. I think that's false. When a person sees...
When did they say that? When did they say that?
They protected... I think he's mentioning that they protected a... There was a some case against somebody who had produced a violent video, and the mentally ill son did something based on the video. Right. Someone sued the video game company, and the Supreme Court said, no, you can't sue them. They have a right to produce this violent game.
Okay, so yeah, I know, but I'm saying that I don't see video games. But we understand there are many video games with guns and it's prolific. And I don't know what the Supreme Court says, but if you push that in and keep pounding that, I think that has a great effect on a violent society.
Well, but a violent society comes out of the popular culture and the way in which we live our lives. And again, you say, okay, in this particular Supreme Court, does someone have a right to come up with a video game and so that their First Amendment right is not violated? Of course they have the right. But the question is, what is the responsibility? Where is the stigma? And this is something I said in the wake of Sandy Hook, and I wish the president would do it. He certainly knows enough people in Hollywood and in the motion picture and the gaming community. He's immensely popular. He could have a summit meeting at the White House and call those people in and literally shame them into maybe taking some products off the shelf.
I think that's the problem right there, Bruce, that Barack Obama, one of his best friends is Jeffrey Katzenberg. I don't think he's going to want to alienate his base who helped him get past the finish line past election.
Is there any indication that the deranged soul that murdered all those children in Sandy Hook was influenced by video games?
Violent video games. He played them.
Is there any? I mean, do we like have any evidence?
I think that's a common denominator in several of the incidents over the last 10 years.
Columbine, same thing.
Well, the Columbine guys dressed up as the Matrix. So are we gonna ban the Matrix? Are we gonna ban Matrix video games? But not.
I'm talking
movies?
About peer pressure. I'm talking about peer pressure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know what? No political leader. Even though pornography. Pornography is one of the it's the reason why most people go to the internet. Okay, it's vast, but you know what? You don't see politicians unless I miss some. You don't see politicians going and surrounding themselves with known pornographers. They don't do that. Why not? Because there's a stigma to it. All I'm saying is that if you are a company and you could be a Fortune 500 company and you've got a division that makes violent video games, it seems to me that the people that are making those video games should have some responsibility. There should be some, you know, peer pressure on them to make those games.
I definitely agree that I think there's far too much violence in popular culture. I think our movies, our TV shows, and the video games, there is way too much violence. But let me just ask, why?
To impressionable young people.
Yeah, but I mean, look, our culture is too violent. Other countries are not like this, and we should recognize this. And part of it is this gun fetish that a lot of people have in this country.
Part of it is our heritage.
Right, exactly. Well,
but who cares in 2013? I mean, the idea that we can't do background checks or we can't require gun owners to keep
who's
their...
Who's saying we can't? Keep their I come back to the background check database.
I come back to Bruno's point, though.
That is...
How do we build trust between the people who need to make these decisions? Maybe the trust building is the place that you start. Because dealing with trying to address a sort of cultural level phenomenon, this is a violent culture. It's been violent since Europeans got here in 1492. We know that much. It was probably, at some level, violent before Europeans got here. That's just the way it is.
But culture's malleable. We shouldn't accept that as a given.
So how do you believe that those leaders of popular culture, are they helping or hurting? Are they making things better or worse by the movies that they make, by the video games that they produce?
I certainly don't think it is helping to create a more peaceful society to have.
And yet, I'm going to speak because I don't play video games. But again, even when I go to see a motion picture, the trailers and the coming attractions for the films are basically, many of them are violent. Not all, many of them are violent. It sells, right?
Right. And I think,
So it's really more important about making money than it is acting responsibly.
I think that ought to be a more part of the conversation. But I frankly, the only other thing I wanted to mention about this trust issue that the professor was mentioning is that what some people will say is, well, the reason why we need these guns is in case the government tries to take over and, you know, jackbooted thugs knock down your door and this is a bulwark of freedom. Yeah. That should be called out for absurd,
do you know what you're outdated talking about?
Rhetoric. Not at all.
Do you know what you're talking about?
And the fact that people want to defend it means that it is this, like,
no, I think, Dan, it, I think
you
it's
should just come out and say what
this.
You really mean.
No. Yeah. I say what I mean, Chris. Chris,
you,
I really say what I mean.
And I'm going to tell you
really
what you mean.
I think it's absurd you that people
want
still
to, what did he mean? Interpret it for him.
You want to repeal the Second Amendment. That's what you want.
What
to
I
do, want
to
Dan.
Do?
No, because I'll tell because no, the
Chris, actually,
ban,
I'm going to tell you what I think instead of you telling me what I think. I think that's fair. And what I think is, I don't like federal judges in Illinois saying because they interpret what the people back in 1787 thought about keep and bear arms, that this state is going to have the right to carry weapons in our state. Well, I think that interpretation of the Second Amendment is absurd.
So
Dan,
and it's going to lead to more violence. 1-800-723-8029. I'm sure you've got a thought on that point. Back shortly. I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. In case you are interested in this and the football playoffs, the Green Bay Packers are going to take on the San Francisco 49ers. The Seattle Seahawks won this afternoon. They're going to take on Atlanta. That's in the NFC. And in the AFC, the Baltimore Ravens are going to head toward the Mile High City of Denver. And the Houston Texans are going to take on the New England Patriots in the AFC. Let's go to Spokane, Washington. They got to be happy. The Seahawks won today. They're going to the playoffs. Mike, listening to us on KXLY.
Yeah, we are, Bruce. Happy New Year. That's our first road home win since 1983. So we're happy in Spokane.
Wow, first road win since 1983.
Playoffs
since 1983.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And then Gonzaga basketball here at Gonzaga University, we're ranked 10th in the country now. So we've just lost one game. That was to Illinois. So, yeah.
Well, you've got good sports out there. Go ahead.
We do, thank God. Well, a couple ideas here on, we talked about earlier, or you did, Bruce, and Happy New Year again. Simplify the tax code, whereas the secretary now pays as much as some of these multimillionaires. So simplify the tax code in privatizing, and you know this, Bruce, where I'm going on this, privatizing Medicare or Social Security is not the answer, especially for those in poor health or little education or disabilities. So let's leave Social Security the way it is.
Mike, were you suggesting on that first one, this carried interest rule where hedge fund managers keep their low capital gains tax rate of 20%, where all the rest of us that have to make a living and earn a wage, we pay the higher federal income tax rate than these billionaire hedge fund managers? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I don't know the exact terminology, but I guess that's what you're – I don't know much about it any more than I do,
Well, I was kind of feeding you a softball on that one, Mike, because I will say that's the one of the reasons I didn't get a our president an A, because as part of the fiscal cliff deal, this absurd rule, which I wonder maybe our Republican friends agree with us, that we choose to tax some of the – you know, of the – 10 richest people in our country, 8 or 7 of them are hedge fund managers, these billionaires. We tax their income at capital gains tax rate, which is now 20%, where everybody else get paid at, you know, 28, 35, 39, whatever. So they end up, we end up subsidizing them, which is what Warren Buffett was so upset
about. The specific, first of all, the theory is that capital gains.
Thanks, Mike.
The capital gains and dividends or things like that are investments, and there's supposed to be a reason why, an economic reason why it's better to tax them at a lower rate. And there's all kinds of data that shows that if you lower the capital gains rate, you increase you increase capital formation. Me personally, do I think Warren Buffett should have a lower tax rate on earned income, or do I think Warren Buffett should have the same tax rate as a secretary? I'm not the one that created the capital gains distinction. My personal view is that no tax should exceed 10 or 15% anyway, and that no one should get all kinds of special favors through all kinds of horrific deductions. And I'll take it one step further. I'd like to see us transition away from corporate, from capital gains, and from all forms of income taxation, and start taxing what's much more effective, and that is taxing.
And I would like to see, the next time we have a national disaster, and FEMA is sent to the area, I'd like to see Warren Buffett write a check for the entire cost of FEMA, and he will be he'll be held in high esteem by doing that. Put your money, Mr. Buffett, and put it where it's going to do some business.
And step back from
Benton Harbor, Michigan is the place. Whoa is the radio station. Go ahead, Ron.
You brought up the point of Social Security raising 72 because raising people living longer. Well, people living longer are doctors, lawyers, talk show hosts, stockbrokers.
Well, let's hope so.
It's not janitors. It's not laborers. It's not working people, okay? We're not living any longer. And Vietnam veterans are all dying of Agent Orange and lucky if they can make it to 70 years old. You know, so cutting, you know, and also, you know, raise their age to 72. That means we need, you know, younger workers are going to not going to get those jobs until those old people are, you know, in a wheelchair on their job. So, you know, why don't we raise the Social Security? Was it after $100,000? Those people pay the same amount as a janitor making maybe, you know, in a non-union job. Where Emanuel just put in at O'Hare Airport, putting in a mafia company to knock out union jobs. You know, so, you know, raising it to 72, that works for the rich, you know, and the pampered, but not for the workers, okay, pal?
Okay,
that Republican who put that out there.
All right, let's let the guy, pal, you want to answer that?
I agree.
I was looking at our Republican pals here, and they're responding to your question.
I agree. It will be painful. And, you know, it's also painful to hear that we borrow 46 cents on the dollar. And it's also painful to hear that the interest alone on the debt is $359 billion. So there's going to be sacrifice across the board. And Barack Obama has told us it's already started.
And
spending cuts is the problem.
Philip, I'm sorry.
If you want to hit the reset button, call Gerald Nadler, congressman from New York, he apparently is now the mouthpiece for this idea of the platinum coin. You want to hit the reset button, do that. Mint 20 of them that are worth $1 trillion apiece, wipe out the deficit, wipe out the debt, have a $4 trillion surplus, and then say, okay, now let's start over.
Well, I'll have to look into that to see if that isn't a fantasy or it makes sense. But you know, let's take it on as something to look into.
30 seconds.
As the guy who said we should raise the retirement age, sir, let me tell you this: I tend to agree with you to your point about life expectancy. When they first had Social Security at 65, life expectancy was 65. But the fact of the matter is that we've got to do something. And I just heard the treasurer from Rhode Island, a Democrat, give the most eloquent explanation in what she did with pension reform as to why Social Security should be split, partial Social Security, partial private. And whether you agree or not, sir, it will solve the vast majority of the problem you're talking about.
We will expand on that at some point in the future. Our guest this evening, the person you just heard speak, is Bruno Barron. He is with For the Good of Illinois. He's their executive director. Chris Voronis has been our other Republican from ASOP Communications. Our Democrats, Philip Eberle from Chicago State University, and Dan Johnson, and he is with Progressive Public Affairs. This program is a Genevieve production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio in Chicago. Our thanks to Dan Dorfman and Tom Veracruz for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week at this same time, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.